Karen. All right, we are just about at time for Brian F., our speaker, our AA speaker from North Fork, California today. Do we have Brian in the house? Yes,
Hey
we
everybody, my name is Brian. I'm an alcoholic. You hear me all right?
Yes,
Guys good?
absolutely.
All right. Awesome to be here. Thanks so much. I gotta say, Rick, amazing. Don, you just shine the love of the program in such an authentic and raw way that it is just beautiful evidence of what happens when we go through struggles and we find God and a program to help us navigate it. I mean, you're just so beautiful, Don. I mean, you just shine, man. It's just tears me up. You're awesome. Thanks for being here. And I want to also say that I have a friend, Julene, who I hit with the flyer this morning, and she said I'm going to be there, and she hit me and she said, "The meeting's full. There's 500 people in this meeting, man." And she got in. She got in, Cassidy. I can see that look on your face. She got in. But she's a trooper too, man. She's one of us, you know. I mean, she stays the course. So what an amazing thing to have a full house. You know, Billy sent out an email and said, you know, he expected 100, 150, you know, but you never know. And here we are. So just an amazing testament to love, to light, to the open heart. I'd say the path of the open heart, and what happens when we struggle, when we focus and face some hurts, and you know, and we look to elevate ourselves in a way of tearing ourselves down and looking at the worst of us. You know, it's like a funny thing that happens where, you know, we get down to this thing with, you know, who we are and what our belief patterns are, and we got to change the base core of what our thinking patterns are, you know, and that's what I've learned. And I'm an alcoholic who, you know, had struggled with that. This whole thing for me has been a path of reconstruction. I want to thank Billy for the invitation. Billy and I go back some time, and we don't go back as far as me and Yvonne go back, and I'm going to touch bases on that. And I'd like to say, I think it was Andrea's how you pronounce it. And I would just personally ask you to please hold your seat and stay tuned, because I feel you. I feel that pain, and I have an understanding in a way that I hope you'll just stay tuned with me and ride this out for the next half hour. So this path of recovery as a sober alcoholic, let me say, you know, my sobriety date is November 1997, and I didn't get that sobriety date by doing anything phenomenal. All I did was I found myself with a big book, and I got the only sober alcoholic that I could see in my arena to sponsor me, and I worked the 12 steps. I didn't do the meeting makers make it thing. I hear a lot of slogans, you know, in AA, and stuff that didn't apply to me. And I often think, well, that's not true for me. You know, like I had one AA meeting twice a month to get connection with people, you know, and it was like I didn't have the ability to have that. And thank God nobody told me that, because I might have quit right then. Well, I can't do that, you know, meeting makers make it, I won't make it. But I did have a big book, and I had a sponsor, and I had the 12 steps. And let me backtrack a little bit, give you a little background. You know, I came into an alcoholic family. You know, my father, you know, drank every day. You know, came from, and I'm in California, North Fork, California. I grew up in San Francisco, the Bay Area, and my dad was a cop in the city, and a second generation cop, and Irish Catholic thing going down with, you know, essentially, alcohol being a social norm in my house, you know, and every social function had alcohol in it. It was not a problem. I can look at my family tree and show you a long lineage of alcoholism that I can clearly see at any family reunion. However, alcohol was a social norm. So it was easy for me to find that as a solution to that internal dilemma that I felt of, that not enoughism, that low sense of self-esteem that I had with my daddy issues, me being actually a sensitive kid and being a fraud, trying to pretend I wasn't sensitive, you know, and all this stuff. I mean, I've worked with a lot of men, and a lot of us have these same issues with this man in the box syndrome and who we think we're supposed to be, that's defined by, you know, our father, our churches, our neighborhoods, our schools, you know, all this stuff that these children get programmed with self-esteem. And my self-esteem programming wasn't very good. And so when I discovered alcohol changed the way that I felt, it was easy for me to continue down that path and use it as a, what appeared to be a solution to this internal dilemma that I had. And it never really fixed it, but it did perpetuate the problem for many years. And by the time I was 14 years old, I was done with the stuff that was happening in my house. And I left home and I hit the streets. And I never went back home. I was a 14-year-old kid who left a middle-class family for a reason. And I didn't go back. And my coping skills I took to the streets were, you know, alcohol and other substances, abuse. And I just want to say that I have a friend of mine who's a long-term member of Alcoholics Anonymous refers to those other substances as condiments to, say, the hot dog. You know, it's like, I'm an alcoholic, but believe me, other substances are a huge part of my story, and they've always been a part of my story. So I always found that change of that feeling that I had, that head change, anything would do. I didn't care what it was, but I identify as an alcoholic because I believe in the genetic predisposition to alcoholism, and it was the first drug that I ever used. So the coping skills I took to the streets were, you know, essentially alcoholism or addiction and violence. You know, I learned that at home too. And, you know, alcohol was in the house. It's where I went to take my first drink. Violence was a part of my household. It's where I learned this faulty concept of manhood and power and control, and men were to be in control. And so I used those two things to change the way that I felt. And as my time on the streets progressed, my disease of alcoholism progressed and my use of violence progressed. And I got to tell you that by the time I was 21 years old, just turned 21, I had been packing pistols, and there was an escalating level of violence, of me using violence as a problem-solving coping skill. It was a problem-solving skill that I used. And essentially, it just changed the way that I felt. That's the only thing that it did. It gave me a false sense of power. And I used that gun, and I shot and I killed a man that I had a conflict with. And for me, it was like I was a murderer. And I apologize, Andrea, for... I don't know what, you know, it's just, it's a lot, man. And I got to tell you that, you know, there's nothing to mitigate that. I became a murderer, and I shot a man and I killed him. And I felt like the gates of heaven had slammed shut on me from my view from the Catholic Church, my upbringing on what right and wrong was. And I knew that I had crossed a line that I could never get back from. And I felt condemned. And I pushed my conscience aside and I moved forward. I reloaded my gun and I stepped out into the streets and continued the path. And I was arrested and I became a liar, you know, just like I had been since I first started drinking. I lied about my drinking. I lied about where my money was going. I lied about where I was getting it. I lied about who I was kicking it with. And I was a liar. So when the police arrested me and said, "Brian, we know that you killed Jim. We need to understand why, what happened, you know?" And I said, "I didn't kill nobody, man. I wasn't copping to anything." And then I progressed through a murder trial, lying and blaming the victim, man. I blamed the man that I killed, and I lied and I said it was self-defense. And this was me not getting my head and my heart around this deal, man. I mean, how could I? I don't know how I could have, but I got to tell you that my disease progressed in jail. I learned how to make Pruno. I made prison-made wine. I learned how to traffic drugs into there, and I stayed loaded through a murder trial, man. And I did not. I don't know that I would have not killed myself had I not had that escape to go through mentally. Because I saw guys do that. I saw that happen in my jail, where guys I was being held who did that. And I was convicted of second degree murder, which was appropriate. It was a right verdict. I need you all to understand that, you know, like me packing guns, and the reason I said I was packing guns and knives and fighting before that, I had this long history of violence. It was always through this ideal of self-defense. And I never did any of that stuff in self-defense. I was a fraud. It was a bullshit. It was a wall of a prison I was building around myself. So when the judge sentenced me to 17 years to life in state prison as a second degree murderer, you know, I went into San Quentin knowing I was going to die, and I was going to die the death of a convict. And so I went in there to live as long as I could, knowing it was going to be a short time, and do the best I could in a place that was an angry, hostile cauldron of heat, of ego, of men who were a bunch of hurt men who just kept hurting people. I mean, it was a perfect place for me. I actually excelled in there. It was like a perfect fit for me. And my life got progressively worse in prison. It's like violence is a social norm, an expected norm for solving problems. And I participated, and I used other substances that I had never used before. I became addicted to other things that I had never done before. I got worse in prison. Our California prisons do not, you know, at that time didn't help people to get any better. It was like throw them away and survive, you know? And I did that. And I got to say that, I ran the gamut. And what happened was, and I got to really fast forward, there was a lot of stuff that I went through, including a year in the SHU, the hole in California prison, where they separate you from the main population because you don't play well with others. And I spent a year in that because I needed to. I was hurting other convicted murderers. It was not a good thing for anybody. And my violence progressed, man. And what happened was, in 1997, I had this thing happen where my sister brought this baby girl up to visit me in the prison visiting room. And I had ran the gamut of prison, man. I had done everything that I thought I could possibly do. I kind of topped out, and it was 9.5 years into my life sentence. I'm holding this brand new baby girl, and I'm having this, Jiminy Crickets, what is this? And believe me, it wasn't Jiminy Crickets I was saying, but today I can tell you, Jiminy Crickets, this is, you know, this little precious, innocent ball of fat, you know, is like, came from God, man. And I had wrestled with God, and I knew she couldn't talk because she'd spill the beans. She would rat out, God, what's happening on the other side? And this precious, chunky, looked like Popeye arms, man. Like she had a rubber band on her elbow and her wrist, you know, this ball of fat, man. And she was like, just total innocence. And I'm in a prison visiting room in prison blues, looking as sharp as I could, dying of a life sentence, you know, and one that I had earned. In no way was I a victim to this thing. And it was like, I made my bed, and I'm gonna sleep in it, you know. And I left that visiting room thinking about what the legacy was going to be for Sarah, and was her uncle B, you know. And I could figure out three things. I'm not a real smart guy, but I went back to my cell and kind of thought it out. And I'm looking at my homeboys, which are all lifers. I didn't care about the short timers. I paid attention to the guys that were with me Christmas after Christmas after Christmas. And I realized, you know, Sarah's legacy was going to be her uncle B got shot to death by a prison guard, got stabbed to death by a convict, or he overdosed on heroin. And that was going to be one of those three things was going to be the tail of the tape. And I'm looking around, I'm looking at the lifers, and I'm like, man, that's how lifers are getting out of here, man. No single lifer I'd ever seen in that time period had ever gotten a release from prison or a grant of parole. We were all dying the death of the lifer, the convict. And here's this guy, man, who came out of Folsom Prison with me on the bus, and Steve, he had a piece about him. He had a light about him. And I pay attention to those things. You know, I see it in Don, you know, I see that light shine in authentic people. Well, Steve had something like what Don's, you know, showing in her life, man. And he was a solid dude. And anyway, we rolled out at Folsom together, kind of had a camaraderie. We had survived something where we watched men die. You know, it was like, we made it. And we were like, you know, this sigh of relief that we're getting out of this place. And we go to a lower level prison, and we partner up, kind of, we're working out together, eating at the chow all together, kind of sticking together. And Steve was a sober alcoholic, man. And he had that big book, you know, and I start talking to him when this thing happens with my niece. And my sister bringing this kid up to see me, and Steve's like, man, let me show you something, man. Cause I wasn't going to the church house. To me, that was a quitting. If you go end up in the church house in prison, you quit on the yard, you know? And I was trying to maintain that. I was going to die in prison. I was going to be an upstanding convict and, you know, do that whole bullshit ego thing. And Steve took me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he took me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous because we got this thing in California called hospitals and institutions. And there's these crazy people who show up at the prison gate and pound on the gate to get inside and come inside and spend some time with us and bring some recovery to us, right? And show us how to run a meeting. And I got to say that because Rick talked about walls becoming doors. And here's, you know, and this was early days in my recovery, but Yvonne's one of them crazy people that was showing up down at California State Prison Solano and knocking on, I mean, go talk about going through toils. These people did not want to let her in because she was changing what was happening on the prison yard. And California prison guards have a vested interest in keeping convicts in prison and coming back to prison. And Yvonne was blowing the pensions and the retirement plans of these prison guards, sons, daughters, grandsons, granddaughters, this whole family lineage of prison guards in California, and the great mighty dollar machine of California prison industry that's grinding out these fortunes for, you know, six-figure retirements for prison guards in California. And here's Yvonne coming in to bring this message of Al-Anon, of hope, of love, of the love that Dawn is exhibiting in her face, man. She's shining it, you know? So she would go through all kinds of crap just to get into the prison to have these meetings. And that's, you know, I got to tell you, if anybody's doing H&I or whatever state or country you're in that's working with convicts, prisoners, it's like, thank you so much for what you do. Because although Yvonne came into my life later on at a different prison, if it wasn't for the people in that prison at the time I was ready to go, I would not have had the seeds planted that came to fruition that today in 2021, now I went into the rooms in 1997, okay? I'm sitting in my office in the mountains of Central California looking at the Central Sierras out this window right here that I'm facing at with the sun coming up over the cedars and the pines and Crane Valley, and I'm looking at Shut-Eye Mountain up there. And this is where I'm at because of the seeds that people planted in Alcoholics Anonymous, and people like Yvonne bring the ticket to freedom to prisoners whose only real prison is the one in their mind. And that's what I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, that the prison in my mind, we build good prisons in California. We got good concrete, we got good steel, and we got a good prison guards union. You know what I mean? And for me, my mind was the thing that kept me in the greatest prison that I've ever been in. And what happened was I worked the 12 steps. And Yvonne had a road dog. Let me just tell you this real quick. She had a little partner in crime and coming in and disrupting this prison system in California named Lydia. And Lydia would come in and do the same thing. Like Lydia is this dynamic little thing that would just come in and explode love all over the prison, man. It screws up California prisons, man. No wonder they don't want to let you all in, because this is what happens. We get a life, man. We start loving people. We start working the 12 steps, and we start learning how to love and love ourselves. And we start building community in a way that doesn't bring people back to prison. And that's what happened in my experience. And for me, the toils that I went through as a sober alcoholic in prison, not, you know, the daily grind of the prison is like, it's a hateful place. It's an angry place. So I first, you know, I'm taking this, what I would call a vow of nonviolence, because Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12 steps, it doesn't fit with God. Violence just doesn't fit that way, man. So I start practicing these spiritual principles. I end up becoming a meditator about a year into sobriety, because I know that the therapy I need to do, there's nothing available to me, man. I'm a convicted murderer, and nobody's saying, hey, you got to see a psychologist or a psychiatrist, or you got to talk about this. You got to lay down on a damn couch and let this stuff out. There was nothing like that for us. So it's like, I knew that I had to do this meditation, because this stuff that was inside me, that God had to come in and start healing that stuff. And I had to open the pathway. And I'll tell you, I'm an electrician today. I work as an electrician, and I got a career, not just a job, but a career. And when I got out of prison, mind you, I took a minimum wage job at 43 years old in 2011, okay? So I just want to tell you, the humility of coming out of prison after 22 years of my life. I went in when I was 21. I didn't come out till I was 22. I mean, 22 and a half years later, I was 43 years old, and I took a minimum wage job, $8 an hour in California. And today I'm an electrician paying into things called pensions that I don't, you know, never even heard of. You know, I'm planning on a retire. I got medical care. I got three young babies that have medical care. They were expensive babies, all preemies. My boys are twins, and they showed up early. And you know, this union thing has taken care of me, this career. But what I know is that as an electrician, you know, we use conduit to make a pathway for electricity to flow. And Alcoholics Anonymous, and just because I'm an electrician, I wrap my brain around this stuff this way. Like, I am truly a conduit, man, for love, for what Dawn's exhibiting, man. She's a conduit for love, man. That God is coming through her, and it's going through because her heart is open, and she's letting it through because of, she's not holding resentment. She's not being angry. She's not working with, you know, all this other stuff that keeps us in prison. You know, this hate, this division, she's looking for unity and support and loving people. And it flows through her, man. So for me as an electrician, I use that conduit to let it go through me. It's like I've let it flow. And it's the same thing I do in my trade. So for me, I want you guys to know that, like, for the toils, the struggles, the things that I learned how to do, was one of them was becoming a meditator, because I could never pray for myself. I always thought prayers of petition, you know, was the way to go with God. And it never worked for me. So it's like being a meditator, I wanted to learn how to just open up to God's will, which is what the 12 steps teach us. You know, seek through meditation, prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact, only for knowledge of his will for us. So it's like I wanted to just be okay with whatever God's will was going to be. I never once prayed to get out of prison. And I went through multiple board of parole hearings. Never once did I pray, God, let me get out of prison. I prayed to have the ability to accept whatever the result was going to be of the hearing. And I prayed to speak my truth, to be as open as, you know, let it all out, to let myself be free of it so that if I die today, I don't have that I wished I'd said. And I had to use tools in prison to overcome the hatred, the anger. One of them, like, I tapped into this Eastern meditation deal. And I would, like, understand, I went to meditators to learn how to meditate. Okay, a common thing I hear in AA is like, well, I can't meditate. I can't make my mind blank. Well, whoever said you got to make your mind blank to meditate ought to be punched in the mouth. Like, seriously, like a big karma punch in the mouth, because you screw a lot of people up with that thinking, man. So what really happens is the nature of the mind is to think. So the best we can do is point it in the direction we want to go. Well, Dawn points hers to love. Look at her, man. She's pointing her mind to love all the time, right? And so she's constantly meditating on love, man, and opening up and healing. And it's like, and it shows. And so when we meditate, you know, I had to learn that from a meditation teacher. Like, I don't take, like, when I have a plumbing problem, man, I ain't bringing an electrician into my house to fix my plumbing. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not taking my car to a plumber shop. You know what my car needs work on? I take it to a mechanic. So who knows how to be a mechanic, you know? Who knows how to be a meditator? People who meditate. I don't ask people in AA how to meditate. I go to meditators to you know, I learn about, in Alcoholics Anonymous, how not to drink. That's why we have AA, to not drink, you know? So it's like, I kind of stick to the script with that. When I need therapy and counseling, I go to a professional therapist and counselor. So, I mean, it just makes sense, right? But we can kind of try to wrap AA into this whole ball of everything, this panacea for everything. And honestly, for me, it doesn't work that way. But I've had to use tools, like when we're talking about traversing toils. Like, there was a time, man, where I sat for months in the day room. And any spare time I had, I'd sit in the day room of the cell block. And everybody walking through the door. And I learned this through a book. A meditation teacher taught this technique. And they said, you know, if you're working with resentments and you're feeling this anger and stuff, it's like, wouldn't you want love and, like, happiness and the root of happiness for everyone you love? Well, of course I would. And what about, like, the people you're neutral to? Wouldn't you want them to have love and the root of happiness? Of course I would. It's like, I'm looking at them and I don't really have an aversion or a feeling of love, but, man, I would want them to have happiness and the root of happiness. And then anybody who's a jerk, okay? I'm going to try to tone my language down. Anybody who's like a jerk, it's like, wouldn't I want them to have happiness in the root of happiness? Because then they wouldn't be a jerk, right? If they're truly happy, they wouldn't be a jerk, right? So I'd sit there at the day room table, and as they're walking through the cell block on unlock, I'm all, I wish you happiness in the root of happiness. I wish you happiness in the root. I wish you happiness in the root of happiness. I wish you happiness. And I'm trying to do it in my mind, but I know I'm kind of a simpleton, and my mouth starts moving. So people are like, "Damn, what's going on with Fowley over there, man? He's talking to himself at the table now, you know." But what's happening is I start doing this exercise of practical application, because I'm not a let go and let God kind of guy, man. That's too theoretical, man. I need practical application. Now, like, tell me how you do that when someone cuts you off in traffic. Like, for me, it's like, I'll tailgate them for 5 more miles and say, yeah, my truck's bigger. And you know what? I can drive really good. I ain't been out of prison but 9 years, but I can drive really good, you know? And so it's like, I'm going to keep riding your tailgate. And then it's like, all of a sudden I think about God, and guess what happens? My foot comes off the accelerator. It's like this physiological response. When I think about God, my foot backs up off the accelerator. And that next thing you know, this is crazy too. Next thing you know, I'm going, safe passage, brother. You know what I mean? I'm saying, safe passage, brother. You know, it's like, not only am I backing up and making an adjustment, now I'm wishing you well and happiness in the root of happiness. You know, it's like, so anyway, those kind of techniques to get me through times of struggle and toil, I have to connect with God. And, you know, this comes from, if I don't have AA, man, I never find that solution. You know, it's like the nudge from God that Rick talked about. If I don't have the eyes to see it, if Rick don't have the eyes to see that as, hey, I better go get a prostate exam, you know what I mean? Because he's thinking about too many other things. He's not open to that. And I believe that God talks to us all day. I get these signs and I just have to attune to it. It's like taking the static out of my radio station, you know? I mean, most of us are a little bit older, so we remember doing that with the dial, you know? Not everybody has Sirius XM, or we didn't grow up with that. So we had to tune it out, you know? So it's like, I got to do that in my thinking through meditation and loving people, man. And the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous has absolutely given me the keys to the kingdom. And what I found is that in prison, I didn't come to AA to get out of prison. I didn't come to AA for any other reason than to die different of being, you know, shot to death by a prison guard, stabbed to death by a convict, or overdosing on heroin. And what I found is these people in AA, they taught me how to live a life sentence. And they did that by showing up and loving me, man, when, you know, I wasn't very lovable, you know? So that's what happens in these rooms. It's like, we get to experience love. And it's true, it's authentic. And then we get to practice it, you know? So for me, seeing Yvonne show up like that, and Lydia, and these people who came in against the odds, like they're overcoming obstacles to deliver love. Who the heck does that? I mean, I can go through my whole day, you know, at work and everywhere, everything I interact with, and I don't see one person that does that until I show up to a Zoom meeting. And then I see a whole room full of people that do that, you know, because we're a small minority of the population that focuses on this stuff. We live the open heart life, you know, we're putting our best foot forward and coming through the worst things that we have experienced. And it takes work, man. We keep showing up, and I keep showing up. And a couple of things I got, if there's anybody, and I got to just say this, because if there's anybody that does this service work with convicts, like, one of the hardest things for me was I took a man's life, and I hope Andreas stay in tune, man, because, you know, I had to come to grips with robbing Jim of his life. Because if you looked at me going into San Quentin in 1988, if you looked at me, I would have bet money against me ever coming out of there. I would have bet good, solid $100 bills. No way. That dude's washed up, man. He ain't, you know. And something happened. You know, and the miracle happened, and I became a good citizen. And I put my damn shopping cart back, man. You know what I mean? It's like, not even a gum wrapper goes out my truck window. It's like, you got a citizen back that I didn't have the ability to be when I shot Jim to death. Okay. And I didn't have the tool set, and it was my bad. It was my fault. You know, it was me who did it. And through Alcoholics Anonymous and the accountability, not being guilty, man, I knew I was guilty. but responsible, accountable, and the shame that I carried my whole life of feeling like I never fit. There's a lot of things that contributed to that, and none of which justifies my action. However, it gives me understanding to know that I need to deal with shame in my life. And becoming a man who was able to solve a problem by shooting a man to death is a very shameful thing. And I got to carry that out in the prison and build community and build better men and help contribute to lives. And coming out of prison, I got to be a good citizen. And I got to participate in a way that I never fathomed that I could because of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm just gonna tell you a couple things real quick that, like, you know, I came out here, took that minimum wage job. First thing I did was I went to Alcoholics Anonymous. I took my great aunt Winnie. She had written me while I was in prison, and she couldn't write anymore because her fingers, you know, I didn't know, but when I went up, I had to see her my first day out. And I showed up and she's in this beauty salon at this old folks home, man. She's got like 10 hairs on her head and she's trying to get dolled up, man. Somebody's working on, like, I'm like, holy smokes, do you, like, that's awesome, but do you really know, like, what's going on here? But she was having her time, man. And I got to see her, and she got to see me as a free man. And her fingers were so gnarled up, she couldn't write. But one of her sons would always read my letters to her, you know. And I got to the ocean, got my feet in the Pacific Ocean, you know. And I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what happened was I signed up to do 90 and 90, you know, with like 13 years sober. But I ended up doing, like, I found out there's these 6:30 in the morning meetings, which is me. I'm an early riser because I'm a convict, ex-convict. So I got that early thing. But then there's these noon meetings, you know, that people do. And then there's 5:30, you know, most of those retired people, retired bums, they get to have breakfast dates and stuff. Like, they get to do those early meet, you know, those noon meetings and stuff. And then 5:30 and then 7 o'clock meetings. So I ended up doing a whole lot of meetings in 90, you know, it was like a whole bunch of them. But what happened was, you know, I went to school, man. I got a bachelor's degree in criminal justice administration. I don't use it, but I felt like I needed to do that. I like school. I became a reader in prison. And these people up here, man, they let me become a firefighter. Like, I'm a volunteer firefighter. And I'm like, man, they ain't gonna let me do that. I told my wife, man, when the captain asked me at the Christmas bazaar, he's all, hey, you really want to help us? Don't buy a t-shirt. Come work with me. I'm all, yeah, you got ball caps? I like ball caps, man. You know, I'll buy a ball cap from you. He's all, no, I need help. There's only two of us. We're in the mountains, rural area, California fires. My wife's all, man, why don't you just do it and quit denying yourself, man? Why don't you let God handle that? Show up and let it go, you know? And so I did it, and I kept waiting for the shoe to fall, and it didn't fall, man. And, you know, I worked for Madera County Fire Department, and I'm a volunteer fireman. I'm a first responder. So I get to help people. I was a guy who shot a man to death, and first responders came, you know, to try to save a man's life that I killed. Like, I created someone's worst day in their life. And now I show up and I've done it, you know, where I'm the first person someone who's having a really bad day sees, and I get to care for them. And it's like, what an honor, man, to carry that forward. And I got to say, Andrea, man, I just got to tell you, man, you just don't know where this thing's going to go. And it's hard, man, but it's like through recovery and honoring that burden that I carry, that which is really a privilege to carry. It's not a burden. It's a duty to live and pay this thing forward. Like, you never know what's going to happen, man. It's raw and it's fresh. And this deal, it's like, I have a career. I got three young babies. I bought this house, man, on 3 acres with this. And guess what, man? I come home, my wife, she's a normal person, man. She pays her bills, but she don't never pay that stuff on time because she ain't got no consequences. Well, I learned how to pay bills. I watched men bleed to death for not paying a poker debt on time. Like, they get stabbed and killed in prison if you don't pay a debt. Like, that's something scary, right? Guess what I did? I came out here and paid my shit on time. Like, I'm paying bills on time. I owe you money. I'm paying you, man. And so I got credit. They're like, the broker's like, man, leave her off the paper, Brian. You're better off. You qualify better by yourself. Don't put her on there, you know? So it's like the ex-con, you know, alcoholics, the one who got the credit. But this life is incredible, man, because I traversed the toils with the tools of Alcoholics Anonymous. And those tools are, you know, prayer, meditation, fellowship, man. When I'm struggling, and I got stuff today, I got the ability to get squirrely. With 23 years sober, this thing here ain't fixed, man, you know, and I got to continue to stay vigilant with my thinking process. And today I get into the solutions faster and faster. And what often happens, and I'll tell you, I don't know about marriage, man. I've been married 15 years. I've been out here for 9 and a half. I married my wife while I was in prison. And she saw some I couldn't see in myself. But there's times where I wish I had my celly back, man, because we didn't have to talk for 2 weeks and we were okay. Like, we didn't have to communicate like that. We're like functioning, but living in a, you know, marriage is tough, man. And I'm learning. I'm 53 years old. My twin boys are 3 and a half. My daughter's 4 and a half. And my wife did this in her 40s, man. And she is a champ and has shown me so much grace and tolerance in my institutional stuff that I brought home. And I constantly have work to do, man. And I have the tools to do it through Alcoholics Anonymous, through counseling when I need it. I got professional help when I need it. And I stay true to the path, man. And, you know, Yvonne, you know, going through some stuff, man. And it's like, my God, I've seen you go through stuff. To carry the message of Al-Anon into our prison, man, I just remember those prison guards. And she's a booming force, man. She's a tall, beautiful, strong woman to come knock on that prison gate. Man, I'd let her in too. Go ahead, lady. I got to get out of your way, you know. And then she brings this message of love and hope to these convicts that, and Lydia next to her is like a quarter of her size. I mean, Lydia is a short Hispanic, you know, lady and just a beautiful ball of light, but she's a ball of energy too. And I'd let her in too, even though she comes in a small package, you know, these two ladies got something going on. And, that's what I know about the message of recovery and going through, toils is that when you show up and you got program, we just keep on stepping, man. We keep on stepping with it. And it's not long, I think, before we go back to those default hardwired. I see you, Billy. Those default hardwired solutions of accountability. And it's my what's my side? What's my role? And how can I make it different? And AA taught me that because it used to be someone else's fault. I went through a murder trial and I blamed other people, you know, and it's a shameful thing for me to say that I did that. I wished that even my drinking had stopped at that point. That wasn't rock bottom enough for me, man. I had to go in and do some time and continue to get worse until I was fully done, broken enough to come all the way in. And I ain't gone back out. Came all the way in and sat all the way down and I stayed. So that's it, man. My name is Brian. I'm an alcoholic, and it is absolutely a privilege to be with you all today. And thanks, Billy, for the invitation, Yvonne, Lydia, and I know my friend Julian showed up. And thank you all. And I love you, man. I love everybody, every one of you. Thank you much.